Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so people who need social work get the help that will transform their lives. I'm Jo.
And I'm Jerry.
This is podcast 3A from series 3. Last podcast, we discussed counselling. This was our B podcast, an exploratory look at different disciplines. And it was exploratory in that we learned, reflected, pondered implications, and arrived at some hopefully helpful ideas. We hope you enjoy the podcast and let us know what you think by visiting our website, www.helpfulsocialwork.com, or by commenting on iTunes. We really look forward to hearing from you.
And we have a few people to thank around sharing the Building Relationships podcast, which is, we're recording this one before the counselling one's gone out. So the last one that we actually published was shared quite a lot. Thank you for sharing it, and particularly for those principal social workers and students who were sharing it. And one principal social worker, Tricia, who's an adult worker, said that it was really timely because they're going to be using it for developing their social work practice framework, which is all going to be around relationships and trauma and repairing trauma. So that's really nice.
Stick.
Yeah, and it was also shared in Scotland by the Scottish Association of Social Work and in New York by Dorley Michaeli, who's puts together a kind of best practice in mental health update. So this podcast, we're going to be talking about assessment, and this is part of our exploration of the social work journey. So we started with first contact, and then we talked about building relationships, and we're going to go right through to the closure or transfer of the work that we do with someone. Assessment is a really big topic, and so we're going to do two podcasts, and this one will be more about how we find out what's happening and gathering information, and the next one will be more about how we analyse and make judgments. Of course, in practice, we gather information and analyse as we go in a kind of two-step dance. We don't really gather then analyse, so it's a little artificial, but there are some particular considerations around each area. And research tells us that often social workers are better at gathering information than analysing it. You know, we've both been involved in research in practice and research in practice for adults projects around assessment, where that's come through from the research and also from practice experience because of the pressure of time on people.
Yeah. Because I think often people find assessment as something they do that's outside direct work or relational work, but I must tell you that assessment is actually a passion of mine, and I came to live and work in the UK because of your assessment framework. I started practice in Australia in the 1980s. I wasn't a trained social worker at the time, but a youth worker, then a residential worker, and then I moved into the disability field. And my work gradually became more and more about making judgments about what people needed and writing about that, rather than responding to the needs that were presented to me. And the emphasis seemed to be rather narrowly focused on risk, but my problem was risk of what was not always clear, and how to make a judgment, how to understand what to ask or what to look for seemed quite opaque. The responsibility that rested on my shoulders felt profound. And the question, can this child continue to live here, seemed to be one I was expected to answer without much of a theoretical framework to hang it on. And so I, for myself, began to search for evidence-based tools that would help me think well about the dilemmas facing families. And I came across the National Assessment Framework. And that was really the first time I had a clear idea of the different areas I should focus on when I thought about a child's lived life.
So this is the triangle of the child, parent, and context. Is that right?
Context is a way to put it, but it was called at the time, it was wider family and environment. But that's exactly right. Child on one side, parent on the other, wider family and environment underneath, or the context into which they live. Mm-hmm. Yes. What that helped me do was take my previous experience, my previous therapeutic experience, and think of assessment as a therapeutic exercise, a way of helping people see their own landscape. Mm. And so I started to think of the assessments that we were doing more like that of a journeyman and a map maker. We take journeys with people and we use a map that we've drawn together to help us identify the landscape we're walking through and the destination we want to get to. And if we've been able to be curious and honest and accurate enough, then we'll be able to identify all of the difficult places, the bogs and the safe ground, and we'll be able to make it through to the place where people want to be. It's no accident that the logo for my business, Strengthening Practice, is a ship. Because for me, assessment is all about the journey of discovery you take with another person and how you help them use the information they discover to develop alternate routes to travel on throughout their whole life.
Yeah, that really fits with this reconciliation that I had to do between this idea of getting to know someone and being helpful to them and you filling out an assessment form to get something. Because so the Care Act 2014 for adults in England, when that was developed, the Law Commission pointed out that assessment is both a service in its own right and a gateway for the provision of services. So doing that work with someone is therapeutic, and you also use it to then step to the next place and access the next things that people need.
Yeah, and I think it is really the key thing that you're highlighting there is that we have to take the legislative requirements and we have to take the frameworks we're offered and we have to get into the right mindset, don't we? Like if you look at the definition is about to determine the value, significance, extent of, appraise. And that's interesting because sometimes it can feel like we're weighing people up, but actually we're not determining a person. We're getting to know a person so we can determine other things. We can think about the things that they will need in their life and the things that they're looking for that will help them live a valuable life. And it's interesting in children's because there's an assumption written into the legislation and the Human Rights Act and all sorts of places that children are due special care and consideration and that they have the right to adult protection and nurturing to help them grow and develop. And so the assessment work really centres around the role of the adults in the community and how they provide the protection and nurturance required. Mm-hmm. And we're always asking, is it enough to meet that particular child's needs? If it's not, how can we support the family and carers to give the child all they need? And in this, we're always considering the idea of significant harm. You know, is the child at risk of significant harm through carer action or inaction or because of the context in which they find themselves living? And as an adult, you're expected to make this judgment, taking the child's viewpoint and wishes into account, but not being bound by them. And that can be quite tricky because if you're thinking of assessment as a journey, a partnership, you've got to kind of think yourself into the child. A child needs an assessment like a fish needs a bicycle. What a child wants is help and a good difference to their lived life. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes assessment fails to capture a rounded picture. It focuses on the issues and problems and it forgets to capture an ordinary day for the child in the age they are. It freezes that picture and that can be really distorting. And I think, you know, if you think of an assessment as a journeyman's map, then you can see there's always going to be new features, new land, new information to update a map. It's always hovering on the edge of accuracy. And this is particularly true in children's assessments because they're growing and changing constantly. The child you assessed 6 months ago is not the same person that you have in front of you today. And so you've really got to hold in mind when you're assessing children that growing, developing, thriving child and how adults around them have to keep changing.
Yeah, and that does apply to adults as well. And one of the things that we're not great at in the same kind of way is capturing the story up to that point. You get the picture right now, not necessarily a balanced one because it might be too strongly on the deficits or too strongly on strengths, depending on the particular thing you're seeing. And it's not necessarily orientated towards the future either in terms of where people want to go. So we're asked now through the Care Act to be looking at needs, the impact of needs, which is the present, and the outcomes and what's likely to help us get there, which is the future. And there's still a gap really with the past, with capturing that. But I think all of this is quite interesting in thinking about what the assessment's for. What is it we're trying to make a judgment about at the end of it? Because that helps us to look in the right kind of places and asking that question at the start also helps you avoid following a false kind of request. You know, if an assessment comes in that asks the wrong question, how do we keep this person absolutely safe? That wouldn't be a good basis for an assessment for an adult. How we help them be happy and promote their well-being would be. So sometimes you do get referrals or requests for assessments that direct you the wrong way. So keeping an open mind is really important.
Yeah, and I think that's, once again, if we go back to some of the language stuff, if we look at an assessor, you know, or to assess, to sit by. And I like the idea of having to sit, of sitting beside somebody to look at the world from their viewpoint. And perhaps the very best thing to do is to look at what their question is. Mm. So, yes, somebody's referred you and they say, this is what we want you to look at. But instead of us kind of going in and saying, right, we're here to look at this, maybe what we do is we sit down beside the person and we say, when you look at your world, what kind of questions does it raise for you? And perhaps we'll never be able to offer all the things they ask, but it's nice to think that when you sit beside somebody, you're trying to look at their view.
Mm-hmm. So that does bring us into the ethics of assessment as well, which is trying to balance two central values, really. So the value of autonomy, which is how people can live out well, live these lives of dignity and hope that we talk about. And also there is a fairness element to it because we have finite resources. So we have to think about the redistribution according to need and to achieve outcomes. And that really fits with the social work, two main strands of social work ethics around human rights and social justice. And some of the ways that we can be biased in terms of gathering information are seeking certainty too quickly, using kind of rules of thumb, or following a particular hypothesis because we want to make a quick judgment. We also do trust information from people that we like more than from people that we don't like. And people who are like us are people we're more likely to like. So we can quite easily ignore views or discount information or put too much weight on some. We also make assumptions about people based on our own experiences and beliefs and look for things that make sense to us. And we also do a couple of other interesting things. We believe what we're told most often or by most people. And we're also really risk averse. So we do tend to pay more attention to risks. And all of this within a kind of context of struggling with lack of time and the kind of barriers that we face and that others face to actually having a fair hearing and people really seeing us as individuals and not labelling us or categorising us.
We do use our reasoning and our critical thinking, but we also need to understand our emotional responses because that's how we make sense of the situation as we're going along. And that links back into what you were saying about the fact that we're not just passively gathering information. We're giving that information different weights. We're tucking it in different corners of our mind. We're putting circles around things. We're weighing it the whole time that we're picking it up.
And we're reflecting what it is as well. That's the bit I forgot, the reflexivity element. We change the picture by appearing.
We do. And so it's so transactional, isn't it, the assessment world, that it's not just a straightforward job. It never can be. You know, and as we're gathering information, we're judging it, but some of that is subconscious. And so we need to find a way to bring that to the surface to keep checking it out. And I think firstly, we need to gather information in a range of ways. It's not just what people tell us, it's what they do, what we observe, all of our senses. We need to gather information from a range of sources, from different people. And importantly, we need to understand their agendas, the reasons for engaging with us. And I always wonder when people ring me to tell me something they're worried about, I always ask them, what's made you ring now? Because it's interesting to know what it is that pushed someone into actually either coming for help or telling you something they're worried about. You know, what are their reasons for engaging with us and how do they feel emotionally and what's their intellectual response to the situation? And the third thing is we really need to keep checking out what we've heard. We need to check out with the people at the heart of the assessment and with others who know the situation or care about it and with peers and supervisors and with research. And it's that idea of triangulating the child's world or the adult's world. Mm. You know, you don't just take one look.
And we've both been involved in work, haven't we, with research in practice and research in practice for adults around supervision and how supervision helps us check out what we're thinking about things and to triangulate things and gives us reflection and hopefully really constructive challenge, but also the chance to try out ideas. No idea too unlikely, or, you know, no thought should be dismissed, because if we're thinking something, there'll be a reason for it.
I think that's exactly right. I think we need to be aware of what we bring to the door, what stories we bring to the door. You know, all the beliefs and the presuppositions and the experiences about what a situation should look like, what people should do in these situations, and what the right answer is. And I think when we think we know what an emotion or an experience or a reaction should look like, and we're confronted by something else in assessment, we can be quick to label it as problematic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, something, maybe it's just a different way of having that experience or of expressing that experience. And I think that's when, you know, really being able to reflect, challenge and test out your own ideas in safe spaces like in supervision is really very helpful.
Yeah, one of the things that occurs to me is that assessment is open to debate about what's happening, and therefore it's really open to being taken over by powerful interests. People deciding this is what we should be looking at, this is what it means, this is what we should do. And sometimes the people at the very heart of assessment don't really know what's going on or what it's for. And keeping people informed and being really open about it, you know, the more I think back to when I was a social worker, the more I think I'm not sure that I made my assessments accessible. I don't know that when people looked at the assessment, they could recognise themselves and really understand what we were talking about, why it was there. Gradually there's much more of an emphasis in adults' work around people gathering their own information and doing more of their own self-assessment, although it has to be appropriately supported. We can't just hand people a long form and hope that they'll be able to navigate it. But some of the best assessments I've seen have either been written by or very clearly with the person that they're about. And we can ask people to capture their own information in lots of different ways. So one of the things I wanted to flag up was some of the tools that you can use. So just lots of different ways of asking people to capture what's happening for them, from noting down what a typical day is like to drawing a picture of that, or filling in a person-centered tool like the good day, bad day tool, where you describe an ideal day or a day that doesn't go well, working on a genogram or circles of support, those kind of things. And there's some really creative ones for children, aren't there?
There's some really great tools. Signs of Safety have got the three houses, where you talk about your house of dreams and your house of hopes and your house of worries. They've got Wizards and Fairies, where you can look at a child's strengths and the things that are worrying them and what they'd want to do about them with their magic wand. There's different islands that they can use to talk about where they live. There's a lovely little mole called Artemis is Worried that helps you discover all your hidden worries that are in all the mole holes. So the trick with it is this. It's about the danger of how you interpret what they tell you, mm-hmm. or what they draw, what they say. You really have to stop after you get something and check in what they're trying to tell you.
And these are all a really long way away from the idea of a social worker as a truth discoverer going in and kind of, you know, detecting what's going on. It's much more about the person sharing their story and then us working with them to fill in gaps or clarify what things mean. And then that brings us into being able to kind of analyze a complete picture rather than just having our partial view of what's happening.
And I think we need to really challenge the idea that there is a truth about your life. Actually, there's often conflict between different views. There's a parent's truth and a child's truth. You know, and part of our job is to hold those views together and maintain respect for them while also continuing to probe and be curious to try and understand what the most coherent and representational picture is. And I think here about something I learned when I was counselling, and it was that people are often as truthful as they can be on the day you are speaking with them. Because actually avoiding shame is a very strong motivator. People don't want to be ostracized or expelled from the pack. And many of the things that we speak to people about in assessment feel shameful. So they tell as much of the truth as they can, testing the waters, see how we respond, see how it feels to say some of this stuff out loud, see what will happen. You know, part of the work in assessment is to remain curious. It's to find ways to help people explore the painful and dark parts of their life in safety. And this really has a lot to do with how we hold ourselves, where we talk to people, how we verbalize that we're listening but not judging. And I think the best way to manage this tension is to use the assessment process to support people to talk well to people about what matters to them, with us holding the tension of telling the truth and consequence. And what I mean by this is we still have to come to a judgment or a decision about what needs to happen next. So when people tell us things that are shameful or distressing or dark or dangerous, we can't ignore them to make the person feel better. There'll be a consequence. But we have to use the journey to support people, to talk to each other well, to manage those issues and to feel hopeful about what the future will look like. And then we will have been helpful as part of the assessment process. And I kind of remember once when I was quite a young social worker, I'd built up a relationship with a young mother. She had two children quite close together in age, and the eldest one had had an accidental head injury. And we were still involved supporting her. And I was having a cup of tea with her this day, and we were just chatting on. And I was almost ready to end my support, actually. She didn't know that, but I was thinking in my head, she's doing so well. And she took a sip of her tea and she looked at me and she said, "I threw him, you know. That's why he hurt his head." But there was consequences to her telling me that. Mm-hmm. But I still had to make her feel okay that she could talk about it.
Yeah.
And that she would be brave enough and strong enough and supported well enough to face all the consequences. Mm-hmm. So I think assessment is not a light task. But sometimes we expect people just to and what I guess my point is, she hadn't lied. She just hadn't told the whole truth because she couldn't bear to.
Yeah.
And when she felt safe enough, she told the truth because actually she knew that she needed help.
That really makes me think as well about the significance that children and young people attach to having a clear letter from, usually from the social worker, isn't it, about why they went into care or why decisions Absolutely. Were made, yeah. Which all has to come from knowing the story and respectfully yeah. holding that truth as a kind of a gift almost from the parent and from the other people involved, so that you can then pass it on to the young person who needs it.
Yes, who needs it so that they can understand all the shades of grey and not blame themselves, and perhaps, you know, apportion the right type of grief and sorrow to the right part of the story and the right part of blame if that's what they need to do. Mm-hmm. I think compassion in assessment work, which is not the same as being over optimistic or excusing people, is really important.
You've just made me think about the ethics of care, which is a theory of moral behaviour, and it's about how we respond to somebody with empathy and compassion. And there's four main elements that make up the ethical response. So the first is attentiveness, which is recognising the other person's needs, what they need from us. Responsibility, which is taking it upon ourselves to help. Then there's competence, which is having the capability to actually be helpful. And responsiveness, which is then understanding how the other person is receiving the help.
That's lovely.
We thought it might be worth mentioning this problem of appropriate and proportionate assessment, because we're talking about gathering information. Of course, you can gather and gather and gather and gather before you get to a point of making a judgment, and people do drift sometimes. So it's not just gathering the data, it's also getting it into a state where we can analyze appropriately at some point. And that does make me think about when I was doing a dissertation and I was reading and reading and reading and reading, and I forgot to reference things. And I had all these great ideas, but I didn't know where they came from, or, you know.
I'm sure that there are lots and lots of people listening out there who really resonate with your idea of, you know, getting so lost in finding things out, gathering things, that you forget to actually make sense of them and reference them. And, you know, if you think about assessment as having four steps, although they do overlap, you can think about building a relationship, gathering information, analyzing the information, and making a judgment. And I think where we can come unstuck is if we try to gather information without a relationship, or if we gather information without thinking critically about what we're gathering and why. And of course, if we go back to thinking about it ethically, we should only gather information that is helpful to the assessment process and the person. We shouldn't keep gathering information because it's there.
So ultimately, assessment should be an empowering experience. That's what we've talked about, isn't it? It's not just a means to an end, which is a judgment. It's also empowering in its own right. And it's empowering, hopefully, because it will help them achieve outcomes, but also because it helps them understand their situation and tell their story and own their story and their situation, what's happening to them. So we have to try and offer and promote that ownership as much as possible. Yeah, and importantly, I think partnership doesn't mean agreement necessarily.
No.
Yeah, some of the things you've talked about, some of those circumstances, situations, they wouldn't include necessarily an agreement about what then happened.
No. But it's always, if they're done well, they include an understanding of why. And so if we think about some reflective points, you know, how can I remain curious about people's lived lives while also holding in mind the job I'm sent to do? Can I find a way to make judgments about safety and well-being that do not diminish or dismiss people's lived experiences? What skills can I transfer during the assessment process that will help the people I am assessing live well in the future? What parts of this process can I give over to the person I'm assessing? What parts do I need to hold on to? And how can I make this clear and fair to the person I'm assessing? How can I ensure that this document captures the context of the person's life and the fact that it is a snapshot in time rather than a statement of the person that sums up their life ever after?
Those are great reflective points, and we'll come back, I think, to quite a few of them when we do the next podcast around assessment in terms of analysis and judgment.